Mr. Maillard remained in his cottage, so I had the whole building to myself, and it was like being sealed up in a vacuum jar. I have never known anything so strange. I think one would feel like that when flying a single-seater plane across the Atlantic. I must have done a very effectual banishing. Luckily for me, it was a lovely day of sun and breeze when I left my hair loft for the last time and drove my new car, a smart black Coupe tilde copyright, across the bridge to take up my transponding existence. If it had been wet and cold, I do not think I could have borne it. As it was, although Mr. Maillard made me a marvelous meal such as only a man accustomed to cooking on a shovel over a bucket of coke could have prepared, and although, despite the warmth of the day, peat and cedar were softly flickering on my hearth, I fled forth from that place as dusk drew on as if pursued by furies, and took refuge on the wharf to watch the last of the sunset. The sun was already below the roofs of Pimlico across the river, for here the bend of the stream took it north and south, and there was a skyline against the sunset that reminded me of the Andes. The river to midstream already lay in the shadow of the dusk, indigo blue, but under the Surrey bank it flamed in every shade of orange, and the ripples caught the light like tumble jewels. A barge coming down with the tide, black against the gold, contrived, with its high deck cargo, to look like a gigantic gondola. I sat down on a great baulk of timber, the water lapping beneath my feet under the rotten planking, and watched the glory fade and the night come on. In that deceptive light the sordidness was gone from the mean streets of Pimlico. Their irregular roofs and twisted chimneys stood out against the paling sky in jagged silhouette, modernist, startling. Then, with the waning of the light and the coming of the mist, they slowly blurred till their serrated skyline became soft folded uplands fading into hills. The lamps in Grosvenor Road grew brighter as the dusk came on, and threw long glittering lines of light across the darkening water, but they never grew very bright, for their part of the world was neither busily commercial nor smartly fashionable. The houses facing the river were old and high, and the light of the street did not reach above their first floors, but presently the dark irregular line of their cliff-like facade section 8 began to be picked out here and there with squares of yellow light as rooms were lit up, their occupants not troubling to curtain the windows that looked riverwards. Then I noticed that across one pair of windows on a top floor, that had been among the last to light up, something moved as regularly as a pendulum. I wondered what manner of manufacture was being pursued up there at that hour, but suddenly the rhythm was broken as the square of one window was blocked, and I saw the outline of a man's head and shoulders against the light, and I guessed that an individual who had been pacing his room was now leaning his elbows on the window sill and contemplating the river. That it was a man, I was certain, for no woman paces a room like that, and I wondered whether it was my red-headed, tempestuous friend, whom I had so nearly run over. It was about the situation of his house, and that restless pacing was just the sort of thing he would do. My mind went back to the man as I had seen him. His image was very clearly printed on my memory, as it is apartment to be in such circumstances, for it had been a near thing, very near indeed. And only the fact that he was as active as a cat in spite of his thick-set build had prevented it from being a very nasty accident, and I was not surprised that he had lost his temper with me, for I must have scared him very thoroughly. He was a middle-aged man, with the pallid face of an indoor worker, the red hair on his bulldog head was graying slightly and receding at the temples, his face was much lined, with the two upright lines between the eyebrows that indicate nervous tension, and the deeply scored lines from the angle of the nostril to the corner of the jaw that indicate irritability, yet his deep-set eyes, startled wide open under their heavy brows, were candid and bright as a child's, and he did not look an ill-natured man. He impressed me rather as an overstrained, embittered man than a bad-tempered one, though I have no doubt he would be none the pleasanter to live with on that account. His clothes were good, but old and carelessly worn, and though he carried the brown leather dispatch case of a professional man, his double-breasted blue reefer suit did not point to the professions, nor did his slouch hat. Yet when he lifted it there appeared a forehead as broad and high as most folks at E.M. top hats, and the hand with which he grasped my door to recover his balance was a most beautiful and beautifully tended hand, broad and square, even as he was, yet with a sensitive suppleness in its muscularity that one sees in the hands of great pianists, which, contrary to popular belief, are never slender and long-fingered. That angry, bulldog face with its marvelous brow was vaguely familiar to me, and I should not be surprised if I had seen it, and should see it again, in the illustrated papers, for a man with a head and hands like that could not be a non-entity and might quite well be a somebody for all his careless dress and unfashionable abode. I sat on in the warm dusk, watching him pace his room, perfectly certain in my own mind that the restlessly pacing man and the one I had nearly run over were one and the same person, and wondering what experience of life it was that had graved those lines on his face and turned him into a restless tiger. For a woman with my experience of men, it was not difficult to guess that man had a sex problem, and a bad one. The untended clothes, the two rooms on the top floor of an obvious lodging house, where he was probably a permanency, the rigid line of the close-held mouth, all told the same story. I suddenly saw him as a man living apart from his wife from no fault of his and making no compromise with his conscience. That poverty was not his problem was obvious from the fact that his clothes were good, though carelessly worn. He had, moreover, an air of being sure of himself that does not go with failure. That the situation was due to no fault of his I deduced from the rigid mouth and steady eyes. There was a man with a terrific sense of duty. Perhaps he had overdone the duty. Women are strange things and do not always esteem a man for his virtues, yet I judged that a man with hands like that would not be impervious to feeling, on the contrary, he would be highly sensitive. Add that, then, to the vitality indicated by his quick, alert movements and the driving force obviously caged up in that rugged, stocky physique, and one had the explanation of the lined face and angry, unhappy eyes. And this brought me back to my own problem, not a personal one, for I have no personal ones, but the problem presented to me by my work. I had, through my own life experience, to find the solution for just such tangles as were represented by that man. Straight, I felt sure of that, but frustrated by the circumstances of his life from all natural and decent human outlet, and frustrated because he was straight. What could one say to such a man? Tell him to run crooked? It probably wouldn't solve his problem if he did, and he was quite likely so placed that he didn't. It was a tragic problem, and one towards the solution of which, a religion that preaches the gospel of love offers no useful suggestions, unless we count counsels of perfection as useful suggestions. Yet what suggestions had I, who am a pagan, to offer, that would be any more useful? For the man had to live in a Christian country and face the consequences of the wrath of the meek if he were caught transgressing, and Mr. Gladstone said, I believe it was in 884, that there is nothing more dreadful than being chased by a mad sheep, and he ought to know, for he was the great apostle of middle-class evangelical righteousness. Between the Scylla of chastity and the Charybdis of promiscuity are much suffering modem, Alice's have to steer their way. A noted authority on the subject once gave a lecture on the limits of promiscuity. Personally, I should have thought there were no limits when you once start that game. Equally, apparently, there are no limits to chastity when once you start that game, either. For myself, I have always been of the opinion that the real secret of life lies in knowing when to stop, whether you are inclining to the right hand or to the left. Yet supposing I were to come forward as priestess of nature and point out that it was possible to have too much of a good thing, what sort of a hearing would I get? Would I not simply defeat my own ends? How wise had been those who sent me when they said, Ayo, do not preach the law but exemplify it. A cold breeze had sprung up with the dusk, and there seemed little point in sitting any longer on the bollard. I had got to face my new abode sometime, and the sooner it was done, the sooner it would be over. There seemed little point in watching the man across the water any longer, either. He was still at his tiger pacing and seemed to have settled down to make a night of it. It was fortunate for me that the full moon had by now come clear of the housetops, for the wharf was unlit, and its rotting timbers were no place for my thin slippers. I walked slowly down the length of the little street. Warm as the evening was, every window was decorously curtained. Behind one of them somebody was laboriously practicing a hymn tune on a harmonium. I wondered what kinds of lives were led there amid the aspidistras, and whether they harbored human beings who chafed against the restrictions of their circumstances and longed for a life that was denied them. There is always a generation's difference between a country's intelligentsia and its average, and another generation between the great centers of population and the provinces, and yet another between the provinces and the remote parts, so there is always close on a century of social conditions being lived out in the land at one and the same time, so it might well be that the general run of the folk behind those close-shut windows were smugly content, thanking God they were not as other men whose doings were chronicled in the Sunday papers, but it was probable, on the law of averages, that out of the 20-odd houses even in that short street there was one whose curtains shrouded a little private hell. As I turned to close the heavy door behind me, I looked down the length of the street and out across the water, and it seemed to me that even through the thickening river mist I could still see the light in an upper window being passed and repassed by a restless shadow. Then I shot the heavy bolts and turned away and entered the great hall. I paused with a flange of the double doors in either hand and looked within. Through the high, uncurtained eastern window the full moon was shining. The stained glass of the upper window glowed dimly with a shadowy glittering like the light in a black opal. Through the clear glass of the line of windows that now filled the lower arches the moonlight came clearly, and through the sharp shadows of their leaded panes onto the piled cushions of the wide windows its. A pale Persian rug lay on the dark polished floor, and in its center stood a Moorish inlaid table on which was a broad and shallow glass bowl wherein water lilies were floating. The moonlight fell full on this, and a spot of bright light focused in the curve of the glass. The lilies lay colorless on the silver surface of the water, but underneath there were strange gleams of gold and fire. I stood watching this softly glimmering bowl across the wide hall, and being raised by the altar steps, it was on a level with my eyes. And as I watched, it seemed to me that mist was rising from the surface of the water and floating upwards like smoke in still air, and that within the mist there was a light. Then I knew that all was well, for the power had come down. Isis was indwelling the temple I had prepared for her, and in the language of the initiates, I was on my contacts. Chapter 6. It is a strange thing, this question of contacts. I have told how my dwelling was as empty as outer space, and my soul as desolate as if I were astray between the stars. I went out, and all unthinking, went towards water, and returning, all unthinking, gazed at water, and lo, I was onto my contacts and power was pouring in, for these things always come through living channels and never by themselves. It was the change in me that made Isis come in, and not any change in Isis, yet Isis reached me through the water. I left the windows uncurtained to the moon, but went over and stirred the smoldering fire into flame, for I was cold from the river mists, and there is little doubt that one has to supply the basis for all manifestations that come to one, and it depletes. I was cold and tired, and very glad that coffee in a copper pan stood among the embers. I drank it, and lighting a cigarette, lay back among the cushions of a deep chair, resting and watching the fire. Now the moon and water are after the nature of women, but fire is after the nature of man, and as I gazed into the fire I thought of the man across the water. Then I pulled myself together. This will not do, I thought, I shall pick that man up telepathically if I go on like this. So resolutely dismissing him from my mind with a banishing gesture, I turned my thoughts onto my work and settled down to meditation. I had got my place of working, and had got it contacted, and now my problem was to find the people who should work with me. I who had hitherto always had to rely on myself had now got to rely on other people, and this galled me. I was so accustomed to knowing that I had only to make the right conditions in myself and everything would follow, that it gave me a most unnerving sense of insecurity to realize that I was dependent upon other people's discernment, dedication, courage, or the lack of these, and in operative occultism nerve is everything. The factor of free will came in with the introduction of other actors in the drama, and the fact that I had made my own soul ready was not enough. The thing I have always feared most in occult work is loss of nerve in the people I am working with. Treachery is quickly dealt with, inexperience does not matter if there is dedication, but loss of nerve is a thing that no one can cope with, and one that is not always easy to foresee. Those who promise most, often perform least when it comes to the point, one is used to that. The air-brittle intellectuals who snap beneath the strainer are the ordinary stock and trade of advanced circles, one is used to them. But what is one to do with a person who appears to be free from inhibitions and then suddenly wings back to his childhood's faith? Back he goes to his mother's knee, and the age of reason is over for that incarnation. Ayo, give me a child till he is 7, A said Ignatius of Loyola, A and anyone who likes can have him afterwards. A that grim saint seemed proud of the fact, but in my opinion it is nothing to boast about any more than that you have pulled the wings off a fly. For, after all, if a middle-aged person takes a child of 7 and forces his own views on him, what chance has that child got of adapting to the changing conditions of life as the years go by? He starts life a generation behind the times, and by the time he is mature he is 2 generations behind the times. It is a grim business, this righteousness, and if we were not so used to it we would soon see the sort of Moloch we had got. I would carve over the door of every church and chapel in the land the words of Cromwell, himself a deeply religious man, "Ayo, beseech you, in the bowels of Christ, conceive it possible you may be mistaken, but I do not believe there is a church or a chapel in all the length and breadth of the land that would let me do so." Probably the man walking the floor across the water was wrestling with inhibitions rammed into him before he was 7. For, after all, if his own wife wouldn't live with him, why shouldn't he live with somebody else's wife whose husband wouldn't live with her, and have a new deal all round and make everybody happy and comfortable? It would all be so simple if it were uncomplicated by the property value we attach to sex and the magical value we attach to virginity, both of which are irrational taboos judged by any standard except the sentimental ones. People break them, and as long as they do not get found out, nothing happens, any more than it happens when a savage, driven by hunger, eats a fish in which is the soul of his ancestor. Yet his tribe, if they learn of it, will drive him out into the wilderness to die, or his own conscience may hound him to his doom. We can see the mote in the eye of our Polynesian brother, but the beam in our own is the pillar of the temple. There was nothing for me to do but watch and wait. I could not go and find the people I wanted. I had to wait for them to find me. This I knew they would do because I was sounding the call of Isis, vibrating it on the inner planes as a wireless operator sounds his key call. Those who were on my wavelength would soon be picking it up, and then curious combinations of circumstances would do the rest. They would come from the ends of the earth like homing pigeons, picking up the call subconsciously and not knowing what it was that drew them. Then I should be faced by the problem of explaining myself to their conscious minds, for the conscious mind is often widely at variance with the subconscious mind. This was not going to be easy, for that which I had set out to do was so alien from ordinary concepts as to appear incomprehensible or even insane at first sight, and people fear what they do not understand. I have been greatly feared in my time, and it is only one remove from being hated. Some explanation, therefore, I must give if what follows is to be comprehensible. I have made no secret of the fact that I am a pagan and worship Isis, which is but another name for nature. In saying this, I do not deny the one God, the source of all being, for nature is God made manifest, but I think there is a time for spiritual things and a time for natural ones, and we make a mistake when we overdo the spiritual. People observe this precept in practice, though they are afraid to say so, but I am not afraid to say so. I place my trust in nature and regard it as holy, and I represent it to myself under the glyph of Great Isis, whose symbol is the moon. The cult of Great Isis I believe I have served down through the ages, and my task today is to stand for nature against those who blaspheme her and so wrong themselves. But the herd mind is ignorant and ruthless and powerful, and we who would return to great nature, the All-Mother, are driven down into the catacombs for our worship, and it seemed to me that, at the time of which I speak, my special task was to show the hidden way down into the catacombs, the way of the inward-looking eye, the psychic way through onto the inner planes where the worship could be conducted in safety and the worshippers escape the wrath of the mob. This we call the door without a key, which is also the door of dreams. Freud found it, and he used it for the coming forth by day. But we who are initiates use it for going forth by night. I regret that I must speak in riddles concerning these things, but not otherwise can they be spoken of, and this book is full of riddles, anyway, so one more or less will not make much difference. But to return to practical matters, I wished to work magic, and for this I had to have help, for the magical organization is a pyramidal structure, at the apex the Godhead on the inner planes, and on the physical earth, two to bring through the power, Shaktu and Shakti, as the Hindus call them, and Shakti, be it remembered, equates with Isis. They understand these things in the East, but in the West the knowledge had been lost with the breakup of the mysteries, but I knew these things, for I remembered the mysteries. I, who represented the goddess, had to meet one who would be her priest, then the work could begin and all else would follow. This was the first step, and the most difficult, for I could do nothing in the matter save make ready the place and wait. Isis would choose her own priest. So the days went by. Summer had passed into autumn, and autumn was sliding into a delayed winter, for it was marvelously mild for the time of year. I had come to love my new home, but its furnishing was now finished and I no longer had occasion to rake the byways for lovely old oddments, so time began to hang heavily on my hands. I had not yet been able to bring myself to proceed with the preparation of my secret temple, where the really important part of my work would be done. The inspiration would not come, so knowing that it is useless to force these things, I set it aside and waited. The thrones, the cubical altar, the couch for trance and the great mirror for the mirror working I already possessed, and I had some of the magical instruments, too, but nothing was consecrated. I was doing a great deal of study, but the solitary working was wearisome and I was becoming unpolarized. No magician can work long alone. My chief amusement was watching the floods, for the river, when in flood, was a magnificent elemental being. I missed the open spaces and solitude to which I was accustomed and which were so necessary to me, and I disliked having people always about me and never being able to get away from them. I began to take my walks at night, and in fogs and bad weather, for then I often had the embankment almost to myself. I would cross by Lambeth Bridge, and walk to Blackfriars and back. Policemen used to shake their heads over me when I loomed up in my black Macintosh cape, and warn me of the awful fate in store for me if I persisted in perambulating at such unfashionable hours and in such inauspicious circumstances, but I have no nerves in such matters. I possess no valuables in the burglar's sense of the word, and walk faster than most, so I offer no temptation to the prowling bag snatcher and very little to the prowling setter, who is usually a person with a poor wind. Prowling setters, in my opinion, are vastly overrated as a source of danger to sensible women. No man risks a snob if he is sober, and if he is not, he can run neither far, fast nor straight. However, before the light summer evenings arrived, I was to have an experience that looked as if it were going to make me review my opinions in these matters, for I began to be aware, in that intuitive subconscious way in which one is aware of such things, that I was being followed from time to time. There is a sensitive spot on the nape of the neck, as every psychic knows, and if anyone stares hard at it, one feels it. I had been vaguely uneasy on several occasions, but had not paid much attention, going on the principle that a cat may look at a king, and that as long as the individual concerned did not make himself an active nuisance, he had as good a right to the City of London as I had. I knew better than to look over my shoulder, but contented myself with giving my pursuer a run for his money, and if he arrived home as hot as I did, it must have done him a lot of good. Nevertheless, The repetition of the incident had more effect on me than I was willing to admit. Moreover, the prolonged inactivity and solitude were telling on me. I could not understand why my work should be held up thus when everything was ready on the physical plane. My self-confidence began to be shaken, and in magic self-confidence is everything. I caught myself wondering whether I was self-deluded, and though I destroyed the thought as soon as it arose, it was not a good sign that it should have risen. I found I was becoming oversensitized by the abnormal conditions of my life, and the individual who had annoyed me by following me on the embankment had got woven into the fabric of my dreams. I was dreaming more frequently, too, than was my wont, and though my dreams were of scenery, and perfectly innocuous, I was not pleased to find that the feeling of being followed persisted in them, even though I had no fear of my uninvited companion, whether in the flesh or in the imagination. Nevertheless, I felt that something must be done in the matter. It did not do to let one's mind get out of hand like this, especially in such work as I was doing, so I determined to make a start on the task that I had hitherto postponed, and get my secret temple into working order. As I have said before, it was necessary for me to have a place for magical working that should be kept for that purpose and nothing else, and into which no one not concerned in that working should set foot. There was a good-sized cellar under the building in which the heating apparatus had been installed. It was much larger than was needed for this purpose, so I decided to get it partitioned off and use the inner part for my magical temple. I sent for the builder to come and look at it and give me an estimate, and Mr. Meyard, stoking the boiler, leant on his shovel and listened to what was going on, for he regarded himself as absolutely one of the family, as in fact he was. For that little man knew a lot more in his intuitive way than anyone would have given him credit for. After the builder had put up his notebook and departed, my gentleman char approached me in a mysterious manner, as if he were inviting me to participate in a crime, and whispered huskily, "Ayo, has it ever occurred to you, mum, that there's a lot of TM waste space in this place?" "Ayo, no, ayo," I said. A it had not struck me. A it's square outside, ain't it? Well, it ain't square inside. A and then I remembered that the hall itself was considerably higher than the chancel, as high again, to be precise. Consequently, there must be, over the chancel, a room of approximately the same size. This was indeed a gift from the gods if we could locate the entrance to it, but I was not minded to go burrowing about the building at random, like the explorers of the Great Pyramid, for my abode had not been built by the pharaohs, and I doubted if it would stand such treatment. However, Mr. Meyard had his views on that point also, and directed me to the cupboard in the corner of my bedroom, which had once been the women's dressing room, and we found, as he had long suspected, that it had a false back. Mr. Meyard fetched the chopper with which he split the kindling and smashed the flimsy matchboarding to splinters and revealed a dusty stair going up into darkness. We went up it, and came, as expected, into a room over the chancel, a perfectly inhabitable place, with a fireplace and cobwebbed window, scantily, though no doubt adequately, furnished with an old double bed and a quantity of bottles. "Aeolus reckoned," I said, "Mr. Meyard, ere that nobody could have been as good as A.E. looked. A, but this was not all. In the corner was another cupboard. Mr. Meyard tapped its back. "A.O. same as before, A.," he said. "A.O. shall we avenue it out?" A out it came, and again there was a stair winding up into darkness. "A.O. didn't trust nobody, A.E. didn't," I said my retainer, and led the way up. We found ourselves in what was obviously the space beneath the lantern, but whereas it should have contained no more than the pitch of the roof, there were 10-foot walls before the pitch started. It was windowless, and floor, walls, beams and everything were all painted jet black. "A-O, well, I dunno what A-E thought A-E was playing a TM at," I said Mr. Meyard, surveying this spot in perplexity. "I knew, however, he was playing at the same thing I was playing at." We descended from this not particularly well-omened retreat, and I for one was glad to get back to the normal light of day. There was something about the prophet's antics that had left a bad smell behind. The difference between his paganism and my paganism was the difference between Prippus and Pan. I had Mr. Meyard sweep the place out, and burn the bed, and then I did an exorcism and a thorough one.